This is an hour with Keith Jarrett.
I think my purpose in music and in my life is to stay out of the corners. The corners are places you can't move in.
Keith Jarrett has just been awarded the Swedish Polar Music Prize, cited for his ability to cross musical boundaries. At 58, Jarrett has done every kind of piano playing there is to do, but he achieved international celebrity with long solo piano improvisations that were the first of their kind. Not that many have felt they could imitate them since then. From Paris to Vienna, from Cologne to New York, Jarrett would clear his mind and prepare by not preparing, sometimes by not practicing for a month. He would then sit down and play whatever came to him, sometimes for hours.
I'm more of an audience than most of the audience might think. More of me wants to be the audience than the player.
In
the sense that I don't have something to lay on them, what I want to do is feel where they are, feel where I am, and monitor my system and, you know, check for neural synapse problems and then let it happen.
Along the way, Jarrett played with Art Blakey, Charles Lloyd, and Miles Davis, and with two of his own bands and a trio now celebrating its 20th year. And it began improbably with a traditional music education, piano lessons, classical recitals at 7, 10, 12. Although it seemed clear even from the start that Keith Jarrett was no average classical piano student. I'm Sarah Fischko. I hope you'll join me for an hour with Keith Jarrett. Was there a moment where you thought you might be in that traditional mold as a performing pianist?
In other words, a classical pianist the way I was being trained. I think I thought that for a while, yeah. I didn't think I knew what else there was. I had already been improvising at my own recitals. A recital program might show various composers and then my name and Jungle Piece or something. And I would have perhaps a theme, and I might either do variations on that theme or I might change everything and improvise something completely different. So the thread between that moment and this moment is completely intact. I mean, that's the part that blows my mind.
It's pretty staggering. How did you even know how to do that? I mean, or how did you even know that there was such a thing?
Well, the easy answer is I didn't want to write anything down because it was too slow a process. And I think that's still the closest to reality. In improvisation, the curse is that it's gone right away, but that's a blessing because that's actually much more true to what actually is happening in your whole life. And all I had to do is apply my already existing improvisational bent in a slightly different way. And since I liked popular music of the time, I did like beats. I did like dance music of certain kind, and that led very smoothly into being interested in jazz.
So in the late 50s, Jarrett listened to whatever jazz was available to him in his hometown of Allentown, Pennsylvania. Andre Previn, Oscar Peterson.
Brubeck, for example, I heard live in Allentown as a kid, and I liked his group at the time. This was a very conservative town, and I was probably a conservative kid at the time. But I knew even there, live, while they were playing, that there was more they could have been doing than they were doing. And I had already played piano 12 years or so. And I just remember having this feeling, there's more. There's more there. They're not doing it all. They could be, but they're not. The very first time I noticed what could actually be going on in a, and I'll use this as the best example because it's a trio, is Ahmad Jamal's White double album from the whatever club that was. Now I can't think of what it was. Chicago, some club in Chicago.
It was the Spotlight Club in Washington, actually, from Ahmad Jamal's 1958 recording, Portfolio of Ahmad Jamal.
But when I heard Ahmad, and actually when I heard the lack of Ahmad, the way the trio fit together and there was space there was swinging, but there was space, but it was like chamber music. I thought, this is amazing. This is not something I know anything about, but I want to. There was a taste being exercised that I hadn't heard yet. Many jazz pianists never investigate touch, but they could use it to great advantage and still swing. In fact, if they don't have touch, they can't do so many things when they're swinging that they could do if they had a touch. They can't imitate a horn, they can't get that thing that only horn players or singers can get. Ahmad wasn't doing that, but he was leaving space for me to think about the fact that that could exist. Jazz was legitimizing a feeling I had, whereas every other form of music, popular was too simplistic. I was already past that. It was unfortunate, maybe, but I was past that. Classical wasn't going to allow improvisation almost ever. It certainly wasn't involved with swinging.
So did you, at some point, identify yourself as a jazz pianist and say, I am a jazz pianist?
Well, I started playing commercial music, so-called pop music at the time, which was like weddings. And, you know, so I don't know why I got into that. I remember playing embarrassing things like the Fire Hall and Third Street in Allentown and the Young Republicans Club. And that was the beginning of my commercial music era.
Jarrett's last classical piano lesson was at about age 15. He was offered a scholarship to study with the greatest composition teacher of her time, Nadia Boulanger. He turned it down in favor of a different kind of musical education.
I was working at the time in what was called the Cartoon Room at Fred Waring's resort in the Poconos with a Dixieland dance band led by a man named Bob Jenny, whose father was Jack Jenny, a very well-known Dixieland trombonist, who became my surrogate father in music. I was very, very young, and he was just going to let me know how everything worked. I needed someone like that, and there he was. And I was, when people say, but you were playing in these funny musical situations, how could you have stood it? I had more advice, correct advice, given to me by people who didn't follow their real instincts and ended up in these other bands and were old enough that they wanted to impart this to someone who had talent. I mean, I played Dixieland, I played cocktail piano, I played dance music, polkas, bar mitzvahs, I played weddings with bands that were put together just on the spot. I didn't know any of the guys. We all had to find ways to do this. I probably learned more in those funny groups than I learned in any famous jazz band. But playing music, I never wanted to continue to go up on the roster with.
Like what music?
You know, piano bar kind of thing. That scene, the piano bar scene, I remember the day I said, I'll never play another piano bar. I do not want ever to see people sitting around the faux piano in front of my face who have had six martinis and are requesting, as one lady did every night, Ravel's Bolero.
No.
And I played it for her because it was just such a goddamn challenge to do anything with that. And so I'd say, oh, okay, let's see. Can I get softer tonight at the beginning than I did last night? I don't know. Can I get louder at the end? Is there somewhere in the middle that I can get more orchestral sounds?
The adventures you've had.
Yes, it's the adventures, that's for sure.
And all this time, where was improvisation? Was it something you were doing on the side, or you'd left
well,
it behind?
Well, to tell you the truth, the great thing about playing for dinner and lunch, but not so much cocktails because everybody's totally sloshed, but I played lunch a lot, and what I did was I used it to learn songs. My repertoire is a direct result of having played lunch. I just went through all the fake books and learned every possible song that had any value to me at all. And then when I'm using that stuff now.
From Jarrett's trio CD, Up For It, with Gary Peacock and Jack DeJohnette, just released. So you learned, you used it as an opportunity to learn standards.
I think everything I've done, I mean, I think this is true with not just me, but I think everything can be looked at as an opportunity. When I got chronic fatigue syndrome, I would never have been able to describe what energy is until I didn't have it. So there was an opportunity there, you know, to actually see something I would never see otherwise.
So what do you remember as the first time when it clicked, when you did what you could do and wanted to do?
Everything started in Boston in the same building. I met Roseanne there, my present wife. My quartet played there for the first time. I heard Bill Evans there when I was 14 or something.
And there was one other thing in that Boston building, and that was an encounter with a jazz band he knew.
And they had with them Pete LaRocca, who is a drummer that was my favorite drummer of, at that moment, my favorite drummer in the world, and no pianist. And John Neves walked up to me and said, oh, I know you. Do you want to play with us? I mean, our pianist is late. I said, okay. And I found myself playing with my favorite drummer in the world on a break from upstairs. And that was the beginning. It was magic. And he said something like, that was fun. I said, yeah, you have no idea how much fun that was. So that started it in the real first string terms. And then when I moved to New York, there were occasional jam sessions. There was a place called the Dom, which was down in the Village, where I first saw and heard Paul Motian out of Bill Evans' trio, and he was playing such incredible, free, crazy drums.
Motian became a member of Jarrett's own trio, along with Charlie Hayden. This is the trio in 1969.
He was always himself. He's one of those players that you couldn't make him sound like somebody else. He couldn't do a demonstration of anybody else's drumming. He'd start out by saying, well, this is the way he drums, and he'd sound exactly like Paul.
He couldn't even fake it.
Well, see, that is something I think people nowadays make a big mistake with. There's not enough education about what jazz actually is. And the young players think it is an imitative art because some of the writers, like Stanley Crouch, even go as far as to claim that innovation is not central to jazz. And the way he justifies that is by saying that if you look at how many people are playing jazz, most of them are not innovators. Therefore, jazz is not about innovation. If those people are playing at all, it's because of the innovators, is what I would have to respond. They're there because somewhere there was light on. The light was turned on. They might not be able to turn the light on themselves, so they might not be innovators, but that doesn't make the description of jazz change because of that.
So how was it playing with Miles Davis?
It was like an outing. He knew I was only in the band temporarily, and he told me even before I was in the band, anytime you feel like playing, just come and show up, and you can play with us.
Jarrett on electric piano and organ.
First of all, the reason I wanted to play with him was that I thought he was going somewhere that the rest of his band wasn't. And it was a funkier place. And the guys in the band didn't quite get it. They were jazz players that I liked. And it had nothing to do with that. It had to do with what I heard Miles trying to say through his horn.
Is there something specific you learned from that experience?
Well, what I learned from Miles was how to lead a band in a way that I hadn't learned from Blakey or Charles Lloyd. I knew things I would not want to do. You know, like you can see things in your parents you don't want to imitate. But I never saw one lead a band with the kind of poise that Miles did. Sometimes it might have seemed harsh, and to some players, they thought he was on their case. The real answer was he was on their case, but he was on their case for a reason. He never wanted to, in words, describe what he wanted. So he was not going to say to the band, I want you to be funky. He was going to say, you're fired, basically. And you wouldn't know why, you know, like, if you asked for a raise every week, even if you were valuable, you were going to get fired. It just wasn't what you do, you know? He'd probably say, you think you got that much better? Every week can't be true. We'll be right back.
You're listening to An Hour with Keith Jarrett. I'm Sarah Fischko. Jarrett's brief association with Miles Davis marked his last job as a sideman. When the program continues, Keith Jarrett, the extraordinary solo improviser. Back in a minute. An Hour with Keith Jarrett continues. I'm Sarah Fischko. Jarrett's life was changed in the early 70s when a record producer named Manfred Eicher with a European label called ECM wrote him a letter.
I guess he heard some of my stuff already. He thought it would be interesting if I did a recording with Chick Corea and two bass players. And I thought, nah. And I wrote back to him and said, nah, I'm not interested, but I would do a solo album. So he said, okay. So on a day off on Miles' tour in Norway, we recorded Facing You. And I think we recognized right away that we shouldn't, you know, just do this one recording and split.
Eicher and Jarrett have just released their 47th recording. This is from their first, 1972. Thank you. one of the things I remember is that you played alone, and even that in its own way was a kind of innovation. I remember hearing it, you know, and thinking, who's this guy who's playing all by himself for so long? You know, you just didn't hear it at that in that era.
Yeah, you mean in the early 70s or something? I don't know if you know how that evolved, but it did evolve, actually. It isn't that I decided this is something no one's done, so I'm going to try to do it. I actually had a spot at a festival in Heidelberg. It was a jazz festival. I was supposed to play one maybe 40-minute set. But I was alone, so I didn't know what I was going to do. I just had a lot of songs at my disposal, my own and other people's. And when I went to start to play, somehow the songs attached themselves to each other. In other words, there were like transitional periods, and then I'd be playing another song. That evolved, I think, fairly slowly into the transitions taking over and the songs disappearing. Then I was involved in a process, and then I started being curious about the process. What exactly was I doing, you know? So then I would also ask the audience when they would come backstage, what did you experience? Do you remember when I was doing so and so? It would have to be something easy to describe. I was playing at the top of the piano, or I was playing this note over and over again. What did you go through? And what I found out was that the listeners who knew what I was talking about at all were going through what I was going through while I was playing. So I thought, okay, then that means that it's actually a direct communication of something that's not the music itself. It's the process they're going through and I'm going through while that music's being played. So one of those things might be boredom. So it's very important as a tool to be able to be bored and then to ask yourself what it is that's causing that. And if you ask yourself that, by the time you ask yourself an answer to the question somehow, you're not bored anymore.
Quite a bit of skepticism about these long solo concerts that you started doing.
Yeah.
And Vakian said it won't sell, and this one said this and that.
Even people who liked it. When they, I think Ralph Towner walked into the studio when we were mixing, I guess it was solo concerts. That was three records. And he said, man, that's great, but how are you going to sell that? I mean, who's going to buy it? It's great, but it's just piano and it's... I think Manfred's answer was, well, we like it, and we figure there might be other people who do. That's basically all we're doing here. Letting it be out, not marketing it, just putting it out.
And as far as your process is concerned, I mean, one of the things improvisers have talked about is the idea of constraints, the idea of the relationship between constraints and freedom, and the more constraints, the freer you are to be inside the constraints. Mm-hmm. What are your constraints?
Well, there's only 88 keys, for one thing, and I only have 10 fingers. That's pretty bad already. you come to think of it. And they're all, they are not able to be used alternately for different jobs. They're stuck next to each other in a very strange linear fashion. And the piano is a series of levers and mechanisms that, if anything, by the time the final moving part moves, it's as divorced from you as your ex-wife of 22 years ago. So, you know, you could say we don't need more constraints than that. I would put it this way. If you don't have total freedom, you will make less mistakes. If you have total freedom, you can make something you couldn't have made with the restraints, but you might make a hell of a lot more mistakes, and you might hate yourself forever, and you might never, ever feel that you should have tried it. But I don't think there's a theory that covers how the thing works. Every time I think I've reached the point where I know about it, I don't know about it. There's no definition of what should happen first. So I go to the piano and it just goes, blang. And something happens. So I'm going completely devoid of ideas because not only am I without them, but I don't want to have them in the process of playing. If something starts to happen, I'll go with it, but I'm not going to be the first to tell the music that that's what it should be doing.
I'm thinking about the idea of you're playing these solos and also doing group work, and the going back and forth must have been, in a way, difficult.
Well, you would think so, wouldn't you? But I just, if you think of it from the perspective of what I can and cannot do with a bass player and a drummer, and that I can do alone, you can think of them as reliefs of each other.
From Jarrett's own tune, The Wind Up, with Jan Garbarek, Polly Danielson, Jan Christensen, 1974. That was from Keith Jarrett's The Windup. You're listening to An Hour with Keith Jarrett. I'm Sarah Fischko. When we continue, the classics and the celebrated Köln concert. Back in a minute. An Hour with Keith Jarrett continues. I'm Sarah Fischko. It's nice to know one feeds the other, though, that the experience solo playing feeds the group and vice versa, I guess.
Well, for that matter, Mozart, someone once asked me, how does the classical and jazz thing work with it? That must be weird. And I said, well, it is. It's awfully weird. I mean, I have to adopt completely different positions and use different muscle groups and practice only Mozart before the Mozart performances, not do any jazz. Yeah, that part's weird, but the part that isn't weird is that you can apply the ability to deal with nuance the way you have to with Mozart afterwards in a ballad with the trio in a way that you would not have been able to do before.
In the 80s, Jarrett decided to explore classical music in performance and on recording. He played and recorded Handel, Bach, Mozart, Shostakovich. Had you known the Shostakovich preludes and fugues a long time before you tackled them?
No. I went to Patelson's, as I often did in those days, and I thought, well, these look like nice little things to work on. I am always affected by how they look on the page. It's like looking at a graph or a chart or a drawing or something. So I looked at this and I thought, it looks good. And I brought it home, started to play it. Thank you. almost shut down that recording after the first 8 hours of recording because I said, this piano is absolutely impossible to trust below a certain dynamic level. It's either going to play, it might not play. And then on a louder level, it was going, some notes were wild and some notes were okay. It could have been so much better. And there's a secret no one knew.
You expressed some disappointment in classical musicians after a while. And
there's a lot of reasons for that. But I think that there's an essential frustration that manifests itself in speediness of thought and a kind of jitteriness and worrisomeness and over-practicing and over-concern. And it infected me once I got into the classical world, and it never left. I was never nervous before solo improvised concerts until after I was playing classical concerts and then stopped. Now I'm almost back to where I was before, but...
Is that over? Are you not going to play classical?
Maybe.
Anymore?
I don't really know. Jazz players have this... Oh, I'm sorry I'm 4 hours late, you know, mentality that, of course, could drive me crazy too, because I'm right in the middle between these two poles. There's the, let's see, I only practiced 24 hours today. This is not enough. That's the one pole. The other pole is, oh man, I'm 5 hours late and I forgot my horn. I'm sorry. I got hung up. Somewhere in the middle lies to me where you can actually function. You can actually pull something off.
It's not a secret that the Köln concert, you had piano problems.
Yeah, actually, it's lucky I didn't know the problems I had, because all I knew was that they had the wrong piano. But if I had met that piano before I had to actually be playing the concert, I don't know what would have happened. But what happened before that concert was the most interesting part and was probably responsible for the concert. Manfred and I had not slept for 2 days, putting me in a particularly vulnerable state that anyone who didn't sleep for 2 days knows pretty well. So I think at one point he said, why don't you try to take a nap? And I said, okay. And I tried and failed. And then we went to a very bad Italian restaurant that was probably 90 degrees, and I got served like minutes before we had to leave. So I scarfed down this not good food, not having slept, knowing it was the wrong piano, knowing they had sold out the house. And the next thing I see are the engineers sitting in there. Are you ready? Yeah, we're all ready. Oh, shit, I'm sorry, you're ready. I don't want you to be ready. And I made some kind of like punching the air gesture as I left that room to go out on stage, like it's finally time for me to do something I want to do. And I think that was the moment that changed that entire series of negative events. And that's why the concert was the way it was.
The recording made at Keith Jarrett's 1975 Köln concert became the best-selling solo piano record ever.
I used to think nothing should last, recordings shouldn't last. If they're improvisations, they should self-destruct, like a Mission Impossible. A certain date, they should just, psh, they're gone. And for the artist, that's probably a good, that would be a great thing. For me, that would be good. If my old stuff would just disappear, I wouldn't have to necessarily have people hooked on it and not able to listen to what's coming next. They could be hooked on it till 1963, then it would be gone. And that way, they would know who I was as time went by instead of, oh, you're the one that recorded the Cohen concert, right?
Is it possible to say how far you see ahead when you're in that state of improvising? Are you in the moment, or are you seeing the next move? Where are you?
In general, I don't see anywhere ahead, no. No. I could even say the best moments are when I don't see ahead.
When do you know what you're doing? Surely you don't know what you're doing while you're doing it, do you?
In some way you do. Part of it is a confidence. It's not so much knowing. It's confidence that you don't need to know. I just realized this at this very moment. Most people think of improvisation as off the top of your head. That's further from the truth than I can imagine. It's more holistic, in a way, than any kind of playing anything musically. Because there's nothing given by rote. It has to come from inside. So that describes what I think you're talking about more than knowing anything ahead of time or knowing what I'm doing. I actually aspire to not knowing what I'm doing all the time.
The standards thing is interesting, too, that you came back to your days of having sat there learning those standards, but you came back in quite a different way.
It was a very deliberate thing. And Gary freaked out at the idea in the very beginning. He thought, why is he saying standards? We've played these things 5 million times. What? I mean, this was like politically incorrect at the time, very much so. Or at least passé, but I think politically incorrect was true too. so why were we doing this? Keith, you've got such great music. You write such great tunes. What, you know, I could just see the wheel spinning. Why would you play all the things you are? I mean, how many times have you heard that and played that? So I said to Jack and Gary, but you see, the thing is, if we play these songs we know so well, you understand how free we'll be. We won't have to rehearse. We won't have to tell each other, play brushes, play sticks. No, I don't want this in four. I want this in two. We just sit and we start something. And whoever starts it, well, let's hope that it's the right thing. So we did our first recording, and sure enough, the reviewers thought we had arrangements because, you know, they'd say their arrangement of God Bless the Child is... And I remember saying to Gary, no matter what we do, I guess they're going to say we're doing something else. But we had no arrangements. We went just in the studio and played the songs. And the idea was that we didn't possess the music, so we could be busy with what we actually did, which was play jazz and express ourselves through improvising.
Prize that you've won. Congratulations, by the way.
Thanks.
That's a big one.
I think it's the only one I know of that I wouldn't be particularly inhibited at saying that it's a good thing.
One of the things they say is about boundaries, how you've crossed, you know, musical boundaries, and it strikes me that these boundaries are only crossed by understanding the differences between one form and another.
Exactly. And it's one reason why I would never recommend that anyone does what I do with those different worlds. It takes too much insanity to do it right. When I cross from jazz to Mozart, I have to change worlds, and it takes time. I have to devote a certain amount of time to that transition. No one told me I had to do it that way, but I've only seen failure when that hasn't been the way it's done. And I don't even know of any true successes anyway. I consider mine just marginally successful in the changing world thing. So you're right. There are... To me, the thing that's wrong with that statement is the word effortlessly. They say that I effortlessly cross boundaries. I would debate that at some length. If I was given the chance.
Right. You cross them, but with some degree of
pain.
Of pain.
Yeah, suffering, pain, trauma, shock, failure, risk. But you see, there's where my heart is. If I'm essentially anything, I'm an improviser. So the risk factor is something an improviser has to begin to start to live with every second. I think the reason Miles brought his band to hear me in Paris in the 60s and other places, he brought his whole band down, and the room held about 5 people, and that's all there was room for. After the set, he said, "How do you do that?" And I said, "What?" And he said, "Play from nothing." And I said, "Well, I don't know. I just do it." That was the answer. That's still the answer.
You've been listening to An Hour with Keith Jarrett. produced at WNYC in New York. Engineering and post-production were by Edward Haber. Special thanks goes to Michael L. Sesser. I was producer and host. I'm Sarah Fishko.
This is what I think. I think there are so many more words about music and so little music. I would urge people who are tempted to talk about it to go find a way to make it, you know.
So, Keith Jarrett, it's been a real treat.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
The preceding program was made possible by the Kaplan Foundation.